Thanks, Caitlin. So we're starting our Advent series today, A Righteous Branch. And so this imagery comes from this passage in Jeremiah. And I want us to pause a little bit at this Christmas season. Christmas is a hectic time. I don't know for all of us if it's already started. How many people have been to a Christmas party already? I see a few hands. And so it's a time that we busy ourselves with get-togethers and parties and buying presents, and we can get so busy during this season that we forget to pause and to reflect on the significance and meaning of this season for Christ followers. And so we do want to pause now, and we want to reflect and look at some of the ways that the Old Testament prophets, those ancient prophets, and how they anticipated and looked forward to the coming of the Messiah, and how the early church understood these promises as fulfilled in Jesus. And so this the passage that we're looking at this morning is the one that was just read for us, where we have this promise of a righteous branch, of a Messiah from the line of David. And so this morning we will look at this passage in more detail. And it's important to note, like you might have noted when Caitlin was reading it, that again and again it talked about the desolation that they were experiencing at that time. That this message of hope that Jeremiah prophesied to them at this time was one, you know, during this period of desolation, when the world around them was falling apart, literally. And yet, Jeremiah held out hope to them. The desolation is connected with the time of the ministry of the prophet Jeremiah. Right? We know a lot about this time from archaeological records, but this ministry of Jeremiah, he was active and he was preaching from about 627 to about 582 BC. And so for those, you know, around 45 years that he went through, he saw the successive downfall of king after king after king. Four kings of Judah went through that. He sort of saw them, their reign and their death. And so you have good King Josiah when Jeremiah would have been a young boy, you know, like maybe 18 years old or something like that, and that Josiah was the king, and he was one of the last good kings of Judah, where he tried to be faithful, but he ultimately ended up dying in battle. And then you have his son Jehoiakim, who died during the siege. That is right around this time when this passage was written. You have then his son Jehoiachin, who was then exiled. And then you have sort of a puppet King Zedekiah, who is his uncle, who is right at this time of this period. And that seal that you see on the slide is a seal discovered in the city of David in Jerusalem that refers to and has the name of Gedaliah on it, who was the governor that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, appointed over that after they had got rid of the kings and taken them into exile. Jeremiah also suffered personally. That I don't think that any prophet of Israel suffered more than Jeremiah. His message was unpopular. Actually, most of the prophets, their message was very unpopular, but his even more so. And he was imprisoned a number of times. He was beaten, and then ultimately he was taken. Sometime after the passage that we're looking at this morning, he was taken by force to Egypt, where he would have died, away from his home. So this was a time of desolation. This is a time where the Babylonians came and that Judah itself, the southern kingdom, was occupied by Babylon, by Nebuchadnezzar, and that it was ultimately defeated. at this time. You have that Jerusalem itself, the holy city, where God's temple laid, that it was raised to the ground. The rubble was burnt. And so at 587, this is when the city was gone. The town walls were gone. And if you look at the archaeological record at this time, that the whole city, walls, everything in it, was burnt to rubble by the Babylonians and utterly destroyed. Now, it may be hard for us to imagine what this sort of desolation would look like. Like, what would it be to experience that sort of desolation? But I think that, you know, we can look at the news today and we can see pictures of Gaza, or we can see pictures of Ukraine, or you can look at any of the 110 armed conflicts that are currently going on in this world, and you can see the desolation, or at least the inkling of the desolation that they would have experienced in Jeremiah's time. My point is that it's in such a time of this sort of desolation that God gave Jeremiah a message of profound hope. The book of Jeremiah itself is a book filled with judgment, with desolation. Like, two-thirds are just full of judgment after judgment, describing this negative time in Israel's history. But then a third of it also holds out this hope for restoration and renewal. And a lot of these oracles of hope are concentrated in a section of the book that's referred to as the Book of Hope or the Book of Consolation. And this goes down to, like, when you look at Jeremiah chapter 30, this is what it says. It says, "Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, write in a book all the words that I've spoken to you. For the days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will restore the fortunes of my people, Israel and Judah, and I will bring them back to the land that I gave them." Right? So you have this book, this scroll, technically, which has this concentration of oracles of hope. And so you have in chapter 30 a number of you know, oracles and prophecy about this future restoration. And the culmination of that chapter is found in chapter 31, where you have the promise of the new covenant, right, that we celebrate this morning. And every time we celebrate communion, we remember the new covenant that Jesus made with his blood. And that's prophesied in chapter 31 of the book of Jeremiah, in this book of hope. Then you have this symbolic act by Jeremiah where he's in jail, right? He's about my age at this time. So he's old and he's achy. He's in jail and he decides to invest in his hometown of Anathoth, and he buys this piece of land. You know, and everyone would have thought, well, you're crazy. Why are you doing that? Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians are at the gate. Right? And that land's going to be useless. But he bought that land as part of the oracle of promise that God is going to bring them back to this land. And then you have in chapter 33 a series of oracles surrounding the promised Messiah, you know, the descendant of David who'll come. And it's in this passage in chapter 33 that our verses are found this morning. And so it's this profound hope in the midst of utter desolation. Let me read it for you again. And I'm going to be reading from the new RSV, the updated edition. "The days are surely coming, says Yahweh, when I will fulfill the good promise I made to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In those days, Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will live in safety. And this is a name by which it will be called. Yahweh is our righteousness. It starts with a good promise, right? That the days are surely coming where I will fulfill the good promise I made to Israel and to Judah. That it starts with the promise of God that comes in despite the desolation, despite everything that's going on around them, that Jeremiah is directing them back to the promises of God. And this particular promise, this good word that he's highlighting, looks back to Yahweh's promise made to King David, that there would be someone on his throne of his kingdom forever. This goes back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, right when David's kingdom was being established. Right? And you might remember the story that David wanted to build a house for God, right? He wanted to build the temple. And Nathan the prophet goes to him and says, No, it's not for you to build me a house, but I will build you a house. I will build you a dynasty. And so God promises to David at that time that someone from his line will always be on the throne. David's reign kind of ended in failure. Remember that adultery and that murder that he arranged? This sort of stuff. And then Solomon came after him, and Solomon did build the temple. But Solomon's reign, how did it end? Not very good, right? And he kind of was drawn away into idolatry. And then the kingdom split. And so the history of the Davidic kingdom is a history of failure. King after king came and went that were all a far cry from the promised king that Yahweh had said that they would have. But it's the hope for the Messiah, the hope for this future king that would be just and would be righteous, that this hope was built upon the failure of the Davidic monarchy, of the Davidic dynasty. There were a couple high spots, right? Hezekiah, Josiah, as I already mentioned. But when Nebuchadnezzar had defeated Israel, and when the king was taken off into exile, at that point, all hope was lost. And at that point, Jeremiah reminds them of the good promise that God made that someone would always be on the throne. And so it goes on to describe this hope for this Messiah. And he said, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David. And so this righteous branch was this anticipation of the Messiah, of an anointed one, of a royal king who would come one day from David's line. This word branch is one that became associated with the Messiah. You see, it has its roots. Get it? Right? Roots? Okay. In Isaiah chapter 11. Right, where it says, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. And of course, Jesse is David's dad. Right, so you have this, and Isaiah looked forward to this day. And then Jeremiah emphasized it again in chapter 23, and then in this chapter that we're looking at this morning. And then after Jeremiah and Isaiah, you have Zechariah used. By this time, later on, it became almost a technical term for the Messiah, where Zechariah in chapter 3, verse 8 says, I am going to bring my servant, the branch. Because the branch became associated with this coming Messiah. And he would be a righteous branch. He would be a just branch. He would be a legitimate branch. And so some would actually translate this verse as that he will be the legitimate king, the legitimate Messiah, because Zedekiah wasn't. Zedekiah's name that he was given means that, you know, Yahweh is my righteousness. And it almost is so ironic, because for Zedekiah, that was nothing could be further from the truth, that he was not righteous. But this prophecy looked forward to the day where God would bring a righteous branch, a legitimate branch sprung up for David. And that this branch will execute justice and righteousness in the land. And when you think of, you know, justice and righteousness, mishpat and tzedakah, that these qualities are again and again highlighted in Scripture as the very qualities of what the king was supposed to be. That the king was supposed to be just and righteous. But they weren't. And so this was something that when they looked forward to the Messiah, that the Messiah would embody these characteristics of David. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, it says that David will do what is just and right for all the people. But he didn't. Of Solomon, it says that because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you, Solomon, king. Why? To maintain justice and righteousness. But then if you look at the later prophets, they sort of highlight, and it sounds like a broken record, right? Where the king did not do justice. The king was not righteous. And so this is sort of this negative foil by which they looked forward to one day this Messiah would come. And this oracle of hope concludes by this description of Jerusalem, which was now in rubble. In those days, Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will live in safety. And this is a name by which it will be called, the Lord is our righteousness. Yahweh is our righteousness. And so the city itself, when it's restored, and, you know, is symbolically named that, you know, to the source of its righteousness, that the righteousness of the city itself will come from Yahweh, will come from God. And this is a scene that we see at the end of the book of Revelation, where you have the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven. And what's at the center of this? You have the Lamb at the center who is righteous. And so when you think about it in our day, this side of the cross, that we recognize that Jesus is our righteousness. Jesus is this descendant of David. Jesus is the righteous branch that now has come. And it's through Jesus and his death on the cross that we are made righteous. Paul in Romans 3:22 says, this righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference between Jew and Gentile. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So this anticipation, like Chris, the kids never did say, Chris never did say, how long were they waiting? How long were they waiting? The Israelites, from the destruction of the temple, of the destruction of Jerusalem. There's probably one person, at least, who might know this. No. You know, over 400 years. 400 years they were waiting. Till Jesus came. That Christmas, you know, about 2,000 years ago from our perspective. So what sort of hope is Jeremiah offering in this passage? You know, when we light the candle of hope, when we talk about Advent as this time of waiting, this time of hopeful anticipation, What sort of hope are we offering? Is Jeremiah talking about? Yeah, I think it's safe to say that this hope cannot be bought in a store. Or, believe it or not, you can't buy it on Amazon. Now, I'm sure that you can buy lots of trinkets that say hope on them from Amazon, and maybe you yourself bought some of them on that sacred day that was last Friday, Black Friday, right? Like, it's sort of telling in our society that one of the biggest shopping days, one of the biggest holidays of the year is a day for shopping. But you can't buy this hope. You can't pick it up at a store. And this hope isn't just wishful thinking or just mere optimism. You know, well, I hope, you know, everything turns out. You know, a lot of times when we think that, well, I hope everything turns out, it usually means, well, I hope everything turns out for me and mine, right, and my tribe. Right, but when you look at the world today, like, it's easy to say that in our sort of middle class society, you know, where even in Canada, we recognize that there's many, many, many people who do not have it comfortable right now. You know, that's why we collect for the mustard seed. That's why you are inundated with all these commercials and ads for giving to the Salvation Army, Hope Mission, Mustard Seed, you know, all of these different agencies, because they know that this is the time of year where maybe people feel a little bit more charitable and they want to make sure to get their share of it. So we have to watch out about thinking that, you know, this hope that is being offered here is hope for a comfortable life, hope for a middle class existence, or maybe upper middle class. The hope that is being offered is a hope that transcends one's circumstances. If you think about Jeremiah, right, who said these words, who kind of proclaimed this hope, that God will fulfill this good promise and will send his righteous branch, that when you looked at Jeremiah's situation, nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing, there was nothing in his circumstances that would have given any reason to think that there was any hope at that time. The nation that he grew up in was occupied by Babylon. Many of his friends, if he had any left, were deported to Babylon or were killed during the exile. The temple that he had so much love to go and to offer and to worship and to do this and to pray to Yahweh at, that it was destroyed. That there was nothing in his situation that could have given this sense of hope. So this hope that he was talking about was something that transcended his circumstance. And it was grounded in the purposes and the promises of a faithful God. That Jeremiah probably didn't understand, or, you know, like, how was God going to fulfill this? How was it going to work out? But he was sure that it was going to. Because the God that he loved, the God that he served, the God that he spoke on behalf of, was a God who was faithful. In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. That this is the sort of hope, this is the sort of faith that Jeremiah had. Anglican theologian Tish Harrison Warren, in her little book called Advent, the season of hope, says this. Advent is a season of hope, but hope is not to be confused with privilege, peppiness, or denial of just how broken things really are. We cannot embrace true hope without also acknowledging the pain and sinfulness of the world and our own lives. Hope is not a trite bliss formed through our own effort, wealth, or success. But the hope that Jeremiah's talking about, and especially this side of the cross, this side of Jesus' death and his resurrection and his promise that he will return, that this side of the cross, this hope is a conviction about the ultimate outcome of history, the ultimate outcome of this world, which is not in jeopardy. In the Anglican tradition, before they celebrate communion or the Eucharist, they will say, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. And it's precisely this conviction that Christ will come again, that Christ will, that all things will be brought together in Jesus, that all tears will be wiped away, and that we will be resurrected with Jesus, whole, healed, and in total communion and fellowship with God, that this is the hope that we look forward to. This is the hope that we hold on to. This is a conviction that Jeremiah anticipated. It's a promise-grounded hope. And we can believe in the promises of God because the God who promised them is faithful. This morning, as we come to the table,